Thank you, Lars. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I used to come to KITP quite often, but I actually haven't been for a number of years, so it's really nice to be back. So what, first of all, I was actually told that this was mostly a talk addressed to the other program and not to the Antimatter program. But I see a lot of people here from the Antimatter program, and so I'm sorry if I will say things that are really obvious and everybody knows.
I don't know anything about
that's, it. That's just life. So what I wanted, so we have this program. It's a 4.5 month long program that just started actually last week. When I confess, on my way back from New Zealand, I was actually spending a few days in Fiji. Pretty nice, by the way. But anyway. And the program is on active matter, and my title was Active Matter, what is it? And it seems like it was rather appropriate because already last week I heard that the people from the Active Matter program had some discussion on what active matter actually is. And so it seems that even they are not really sure. So let's see if we can try to give some answers or propose at least some definition today. The official title of the program actually is Active Matter, and I don't even remember it myself, but colon, cytoskeleton, cells, tissues, and flocks. So the first thing you see is that active matter is a bit of everything, and I'll try to tell you what I mean by that. So what I want to try to do today is tell you a little bit what defines active matter, and active matter generally is matter that is out of equilibrium, but in a way that is different from more familiar non-equilibrium systems. So I want to tell you what defines it and how it is different from other non-equilibrium systems. I will give you some examples, both from the living and the non-living world. And I will try to outline very broadly some of the theoretical goals of this program that just started and will go on for some time. I should say that I actually started working on what has now become and acquired the name of active matter back more than 10 years ago as a result of being at KITP for a program on complex fluids, where I heard some talks on cell constituents and their interactions and their mechanics. And it was these talks that started a collaboration with Tandy Liverpool, with whom from the UK, with whom I then worked for quite some time, and eventually led to my switching from working in on vortices in superconductors, sounds very different, to working on active matter. So I feel it's very appropriate for me to be here today, and I'm very happy to tell you about the field. Now, if by the end of the talk you're interested in learning more about it, we have recently, a group of us has recently completed a Reviews of Modern Physics article. I will invite you to go and have a look. It starts out, it gets fairly technical later on, but the introduction I think is quite nice, lots of pretty pictures that I won't be able to show today. So you can go and have a look there about active matter. Now, so what I said is that I promise to tell you what it is, give you some examples, and tell you about the goals of the program. Before I actually try to define it, though, I'd like to start with an example that I think can be sort of relatively familiar to everybody. So the example I want to use is that of a bacterial suspension. Let's first think about one bacteria. Let's think about one E. coli. Everybody has heard about E. coli. E. coli is a rod-shaped bacterium. It has a body, sort of like a rod, which is about maybe a couple of microns in length. It's about half a micron thick. And it has four flagella, four of them, which actually are much longer. They can be as long as 10 to 20 microns. And it swims in a fluid and undergoes a particular type of motion, which is called run and tumble, because it travels in a straight line at a speed V naught which can be anything from 10 to 40 microns per second, depending on condition. And then, and it travels by rotating the four flagella, the four sort of like a helix. And then, every second or so, it spreads out the flagella, and it undergoes what's called a tumble, which means that it changes direction drastically, and then it goes on. So straight runs at speed V naught, and about every second, a tumble, which changes direction. Very different dynamics from that of a so-called Brownian particle, the famous grain of pollen in air, that undergoes a random walk, meaning it has equal probability of going in all directions at any given time. This is technically what's called a persistent random walk. Yeah. And actually, at long times, the mean square displacement, that is, if I were to calculate position at time t minus position at time zero, square it, and average it, the mean square displacement is still diffusive. It grows linearly in time. And the diffusion coefficient is actually given by V naught squared divided the tumble rate. Alpha t is the tumble rate, which is about one tumble per second. Much larger than the thermal diffusion coefficient for a Brownian particle of the corresponding size in water. Let's call that d thermal, say, about 100 times larger. So thermal fluctuations are always negligible. The dynamics is entirely described by this type of behavior, which is still, however, diffusive a long time. But as we will see, the fact that the motion is as this straight flight makes some important differences. Now, in addition, so this swims in a fluid, say water for now, and it swims in a regime of so-called very low, in fact zero practically, Reynolds number, in which inertia is essentially negligible. So the classical dynamics of this object is not F equal ma, but is F equal zero, essentially. And that also, it's a rather novel kind of regime, different from our usual experience. So that's one E. coli. Now, if you take many and put it together at, you know, the dense, let them reproduce and so on, and you have a dense collection of E. coli, what happens is that, well, first of all, in addition to this self-propulsion, as we call it, there'll be interactions, all kinds of interactions. So-called hydrodynamic interactions mediated by the fluid. I swim here, I generate a flow, and my neighbor feels it. A short range, of course, steric effects, the fact that these things have a finer size and they can't be on top of each other. All kinds of biochemical, possibly, interactions and so on. So self-propulsion plus interactions leads to a kind of highly coordinated dynamics. At large scales. And in particular, there are two kinds of behavior that you see. In the presence of rich nutrients, when these guys are well fed, what you see is what has been called bacterial turbulence. What that means is that you see a lot of swirling motion at scales much larger than the size of an individual bacteria. You see a lot of vorticity in the system. And to anybody who knows about turbulence, this is surprising because these guys are in a regime of zero Reynolds number. Turbulence in fluid, of course, a Reynolds number of the order of 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5. So this is a very different type of turbulence, and a lot of it is coordinated motion with vorticity at very large scales. When you start them, then there is all kinds of complicated, interesting pattern formation takes place, meaning these things organize themselves. So for instance, you might inoculate a drop of the bacteria at first on a plate, and the drop first expands, and then first expands radially in a sort of bigger drop, but then they start maybe forming rings, So these, the white, this will be high density of bacteria, and the rest is no bacteria, so rings of high density. The rings may break up. These lines are just for me to make a drawing here. The ring may break up in spots, or the spots themselves may arrange in what looks almost hexagonal lattice. So all kinds of complicated pattern formation. And the type of pattern that you get depends on, of course, how long you wait, but also depends on precisely how you start them and various conditions, and the particular strain you may actually have in your kind of bacteria. But again, some kind of coordinated dynamics at large scale. Now, so that's the example. And the idea here is that you have particles, that individually is self-propelled, and collectively they produce coherent motion, coherent dynamics at large scale. If you like, that's my definition of active matter. So active matter, I would say, is any collection of interacting units that are individually driven. I don't think it has to be internally driven, because I'll give you an example to the opposite, but individually driven, and collectively generate motion and function at large scales. So what active matter, we could say that is characterized by what I would like to call sort of a reverse energy cascade. And here I'm borrowing a little bit from the language of turbulence, indeed. So familiar, non-equilibrium systems are familiar to us. You might drive them out of equilibrium with a fluid, say you might shear it at the boundary, or apply a temperature gradient, or a magnetic system, you might apply an electric field, so a magnetic field. So in both cases, you are applying energy globally, same everywhere, or you are applying energy at a large scale, in the case of the fluid. And this energy then cascades down in three-dimensional turbulence to the low scale and generates turbulence. Here is sort of the opposite. You are injecting energy in the system at the small scale, because here, through perhaps nutrients that these things take up, your energy is injected at the small scale, and then it's transduced at the large scale into some type of organized motion. So that's why this name, reverse energy cascade, that actually came up during a discussion recently in Santa Barbara for a workshop run by the NSF, and that Paul Chaykin really liked, so I decided, okay, we'll adopt it. So this reverse energy cascade, the symmetry is broken locally rather than globally. Again, magnetic field, you break the symmetry globally. Here the symmetry is broken locally, and yet, as we will see, a lot of order is possible in this kind of systems. And so in general, you get this type of, as people call it, emergent behavior. Now, examples, we can think of examples on many, many scales and of very different types, in addition to the ones I just mentioned here. Of course, examples are schools of fish, birds, even people. This has actually been used for describing groups of people. In addition to the bacteria, other types of cells. The cell itself can be thought of as an active system because the cell is composed of active elements that are large scale. So in fact, before saying the cell, perhaps I should say the cell cytoskeleton, and I'll tell you what that is shortly, which is sort of the structure that drives, for instance, cell motility, the mechanical property of cells, and so on. Many cells, in for instance, determining the properties and the formation of tissues, but also non-living systems. For instance, if you just add a monolayer of granular material, say a rod, and you vibrate it, if it's a monolayer, then you will inject energy on each rod individually. And so that actually has many similarities with active systems. So let's say vibrated layers. Systems called active, so artificial microswimmers. And a lot more. And what I'm trying to stress here is that there are examples on many, many different scales. And of course, as physicists and as theorists, our goal is to use statistical mechanics and tools for soft condensed matter physics to try to classify the system and identify generic properties. In particular, we like to understand what are the phases of active matter. We can actually, as we will see shortly, we can have active gases, active liquids, liquid crystals, glasses, solids, and so on. In some cases, perhaps we should call them regimes rather than phases, although it's actually very tempting sometimes to call them phases. How the transition between the different phases of regimes take place, and what are their properties? What are, ask all the questions we usually ask about matter. What is the mechanics? What is the rheology? And so on. Pattern formations. Another thing very interesting that has come up recently, since there are field theorists in the audience, is when you talk about ordered phases of active matter, then we start talking about topological defects in the ordered phases and what is their role, which is actually very different from that played in equilibrium. So what I want to do now, this was sort of a generic kind of overview, and now what I really want to do is to try to give you a very preliminary rough classification first, and then give you three examples from each one of the groups that I will put on the board in a minute. Of course, I'd be happy to ask any questions if anybody wants to interrupt me anytime. So the kind of classification I want to pick up is based on the what I would call the types of active particles. And the types of order that we can get. And of course, my active particles, maybe the fish, maybe the cell, maybe the cytoskeletal filaments, and so on. But roughly, we can classify them as follows. First of all, most of my active particles generally are elongated objects, certainly fish, birds, even people to some extent. They have even though they don't travel along their direction, their long direction generally. They are elongated objects. Now, we know that liquids of rod-like molecules can actually form states with orientational order where all these molecules are on average aligned in the same direction. These are called liquid crystals. More precisely, this is the simplest of liquid crystals. It's called an hematic liquid crystal. And they are liquids because there is orientational order, but there is no positional or translational order, so these things flow. These are generally elongated objects, the active particles, and so they also can order in liquid crystal-like states with orientational order. But there are sort of two types of active particles. We may have types of active particles that have a head and a tail. Let's draw them like that. They're self-propelled, that's what this arrow indicates, but they have a head and a tail, so like the fish or the E. coli. So these particles are themselves polar, with no reference to charge, we just call them polar. And of course, if they order, they will order in a state that has the symmetry of a ferromagnet. Furthermore, let's say that the order state will have ferromagnetic symmetry. And also, it will be a moving state, because if they are moving individually with some velocity and they all order in the same direction, the state would be one that is globally moving. There are, however, active particles that, although elongated, I will draw them with two arrows, they actually have no head or a tail. An example, well, my vibrated rods, if they're actually symmetric rods, is an example of that. But another example are melanocytes, the cells that actually shake to spread around pigment in your skin. And some fibroblasts as well, they tend to go back and forth. And you cannot really tell a head and a tail, they just kind of go back and forth. They're active, they're moving around, but they're not going anywhere. So these are the particles themselves are polar. And they will order now in a state in this, which is like has the symmetry of a nematic liquid crystal. So when these order, they're like rods with no head and tail. And so the type of order you get is nematic in the sense that there is order in orientation but not in direction. This sense is the same as that. And this order state will not be a moving state globally. So the order parameter will have to be different. In this case, the order parameter is a vector. In this case, the order parameter for the simplest case will be a uniaxial tensor. There are actually also ethic particles that are, for instance, what we call ethic colloids, and I'll give you an example in a minute, are just spheres, colloidal particles, but are self-propelled. So these ones, clearly, they will not order in a state with orientational order, although they can be local, depends on the type. Of course, it depends also on the type of interactions. I'm like leaving interactions aside here. But certainly because of their shape, they will not order in states with orientational order. And yet we'll see that they have some quite surprising and novel behavior. So what I want to do is give you sort of quickly an example from each one, if I make it, from each one of these three groups. And I should add that how do we actually attack theoretically these kind of systems? Well, we use sort of the usual tools. We use simulation. We use, I would like to call them field theories, although I know the sound of the audience may not like this, but they're classical field theories. And of course, experiments. I don't do experiments personally, but one of the big challenges in this field, and one that we are hoping actually to work on in this program, is to make contact, quantitative contact, between theory and experiment. So what I'm going to try to do is give you sort of an example for each one of these classes, and each example will refer to a different way of looking at the system. So let me go back to the other end of the board. So the first example is a model that has been mainly studied numerically, and that was designed to describe polar active particles. And it's sort of at the origin of the whole field. It's called by physicists the Wiechek model. Tomasz Wiechek proposed this in 1995. And what he really had in mind, indeed, is to propose a statistical mechanics type of model that would describe the flocking of birds. And the model is inspired by the statistical physics model of ferromagnetism that we have. It's essentially a model of flying spins. In fairness, I should say that the model was actually developed in 1987 by Craig Reynolds, a computer scientist working for the animation industry. Who actually won an Oscar for, I don't remember exactly which movie, but for animation, things like the Wildebeest Stampede of the Lion King, that's kind of thing they did with this kind of model, long before Wiechek proposed it for describing to the physicist audience. But we call it the Wiechek model anyway. And so the model is really very simple. Essentially, it's a model of N. So first of all, everything I'm going to tell you today is in two dimensions. I should have said that at the beginning. Of course, not all active systems are in two dimensions, birds in particular, since certainly are not. But today, I'm just sticking to two dimensions. So it's a model of n-point particles in two dimensions. And the particles themselves are simply described by a velocity. So they are arrows, they are spins. The magnitude of the velocity has a fixed value of v-naught. And so really, the only degree of freedom is an angle in two dimensions. So V0 is fixed. And essentially, what these particles do is that they at every time step, they look at their neighbors within some range. And they align with their neighbors with some mistakes. And then they move forward one step. Okay. So the dynamics is what we would call overdamped. There are particles moving on a substrate. So let's say that I have other spins here, pointing in some other direction. I look at every time step, I look at my neighbors, I align on average with my neighbors, including myself, I calculate the mean angle, and I move forward one step. But there is some noise. I move forward, so the alignment is not perfect. There is some noise of some strength. Let's call it eta. And what happens in this system is that as a function of either noise strength or of the density, the number of spins you have, there is actually a phase transition. The ordered parameter characterizing the transition is the mean speed. So I will do 1 over n, sum over all the particles of the velocity of each one, take the magnitude. And the order state has a non-zero v, the disorder state is zero v. And what you, if you simulate this model numerically, what you find, so let's plot v over v naught as a function of disorder. When the disorder is small, so say this is 1, there is an order state, disorder gets large, it goes to a disorder state. The nature of the transition was first thought to be second order. Today is probably believed to be actually first order, which had rather complicated coexistence near the transition region. But Tomasz Wicek in particular still believes it's continuous, so there's still there is still some discussion on that. But one thing that was interesting when this was proposed is that this is a model in two dimensions with a continuous symmetry that is broken, which is in equilibrium forbidden by the so-called Mermet-Wagner theorem. But here is allowed, it happens, because the system is a non-equilibrium system. And the reason this really happens is sort of vaguely because...
excuse me.
Yes.
Do you mean that the rotational symmetry is
yes.
broken?
What did I say? Maybe I said something
well,
else.
Well, you said asymmetry is broken.
But yeah, it's a, the rotational symmetry. Yes, absolutely. The rotational symmetry is broken because the system on average now is moving in a fixed direction. This has a non-zero, it's like a non-zero magnetization, if you want. Okay? The reason this happens is the fact that this order parameter is really at the same time an order parameter of the velocity. So in two dimensions, what forbids the order state from being there is the fact that, say, we have an order state in some direction. Then you calculate, say, the fluctuations in the deviation, no, in the angle, in the angle of fluctuation, and you find that they get very large at large distances, and this destroys the phase transition. But what happens here is that a fluctuation in the order parameter is also a fluctuation in the velocity. So in some vague sense, it actually travels a distance in a time t. And so effectively, it's as if the system almost had longer range interactions. And of course, this is just work. There are calculations to go behind this. But effectively, that's why this happened. And this is intimately related to the fact that this is both an order parameter and the velocity. There are terms allowed in the continuum model that has been built by Toner and Tu a long time ago to describe this that, that arise because of this. Yes.
Isn't there instability to sort of one flock going into two flocks, which still has v not equal to zero?
Well, yes. So that is why, so the order state, which here I just described this way, is very complicated. There are, so one of the properties of the system is very large density fluctuations. So first of all, here, I haven't said anything. So this is called the flocking transition. There is no real flock, the way I told you. It just, you know, flocking is a cohesive object. Okay. Now, if you actually look at the behavior near the transition, there are actually a lot of clustering. There are very large density fluctuations. And this can certainly happen, what you described. In fact, one of the properties of this model and the continuum model derived from it is that if you calculate, so you take a region, calculate the mean number of particles in that region, and then let's call it an average, and then calculate the deviation from the number, and then calculate the variance, calculate, so actually let me call this by that, okay? And then I calculate delta n square average, square root, okay? In any system that obeys the central limit theorem, This is supposed to grow like root 10, so that I will call this just delta. Okay, let me just call it delta. So that delta over n goes like 1 over root n and goes to 0 at infinity. In this system, this exponent, instead of being 1f, is some exponent alpha, which theoretically in 2 dimensions is equal to 1. Experimentally, actually, has been measured both in simulation and in some bacterial suspension, is of the order of 0.8. So this is characterized by very large number of fluctuations, and it's this fact is partly related to what described to this very strong clustering and so on that the model actually exhibits.
Can you write down the lambda Ginzburg potential, which gives rise to this?
Well, we, so this is not equilibrium. When I say we use field theories, I can, but when, I mean, not quite. When I say we use field theories, these are field theories, but not from a free energy. Okay? We don't have a free energy. What we have to write down is dynamical equations. So, yes, so if you want to describe the system, you will write, I can do this, but then I will have to skip some of my rest of my talk. I will write an equation for a density and, say, a velocity. Okay? So the equation for the density, the particles are conserved, so it would just be something like that, a continuity equation. And the equation for the velocity, okay, is sort of like a Navier-Stokes equation, with the density here, but with some important differences. Okay, so in a Navier-Stokes equation, this coefficient will be 1. Here, actually, it can be different from 1 because it's a non-equilibrium system. Let me erase some stuff here. Here you would have a gradient of pressure leading order. This gradient of pressure is proportional to density, so I'm just going to write it, and will contain actually this kind of a V naught in it. Then you would have other non-equilibrium terms. For instance, you could have a V divergence of V. Actually, the density should also have terms proportional to V squared. The pressure contains also terms proportional to V squared because V is the order parameter. And so it does come. This, if you like, is the gradient of the pressure, and the pressure depends both on density and on the magnitude of the order parameter. And that's where it comes in, this fact that this is as this dual role of velocity and order parameter. Try to get something important here. There are other terms that one writes down, other order nonlinear terms. This is known as the Toner and Tu model, who actually sort of the first one who developed the continuum model that describes the Dirichlet model. Okay? And we can talk about this some more if you want. But. So these kind of models generally are either written down on the basis of symmetry, or they've actually also been derived by cross-graining microscopic models of this type. I mean, we have microscopic equation of motion. I didn't write down here, but that's that is possible.
Is there a diffusion term, or is it more like an Euler equation?
Sorry, no, there is. So let's call it K. Yes. No, there is. Sorry, I just still I have some others I didn't write down, but. And in principle, well, okay, that's the simplest one you can write down. Yeah. And again, this is like an order parameter. This you could think of it sort of like a viscosity, if you think of it as a velocity. Or if you know about liquid crystals, this is like the elastic constant for a liquid crystal that says how much energy costs to deviate from the direction of order. Okay, so there is this kind of dual role of this V, which is important for the understanding of these systems. Okay. There are many open questions here that I'm not going to mention. One of the ones that people are working on right now is so this is sort of a minimal model of flocking. It's trying to develop a minimal model of flocking that actually will describe the behavior of cells as a cell interacting with each other and with substrates when in the context of tissue formation. The interactions are much more, they have to be more complicated, but one would like to extract the essential feature and develop similar type of what I would call agent-based model. So this is a model where the interaction is I look at my neighbors and I align with them. It's not what I would call a physical interaction. Hydrodynamic interactions, steric effects, those are physical interactions. And so, but I would like just to mention this and stop there because I'd like to see if I can get to tell you a little bit about the other ones.
Can I proceed? If you're a low Reynolds number, which is not the birds in air, but other cases, you would naturally get that hydrodynamical interaction, but when you go with the mean flow generated by your neighbor.
Yes, absolutely. I'm just saying that's not in this model. There has been a lot of work on the following question by people here, including myself. If you now actually construct a model where you have particles that are self-propelled and interact with each other through either hydrodynamic interaction or even just steric effects, okay, what happens? Can you get this order state? And the answer is complicated. but absolutely, that's, Now, the next thing I want to show you, though, is just spend 1 minute. Actually, I want to show you a movie about what happens for this kind of colloids, spherical particles. Now, in this case, the movie I will show is actually an experiment. And it's an experiment on so-called active colloids. What are active colloids? Well, colloids are micron-sized polystyrene beads in a fluid that can do all kinds of interesting things. If you take one of these beads and coat half of it with platinum and put it in a solution that contains hydrogen peroxide, the platinum catalyzes the reaction that splits hydrogen peroxide, and therefore creates, and is an exothermic reaction, and therefore creates thermal and chemical gradients. And as a result, the colloids become self-propelled, essentially. Now, the experiment I will show you is a little bit more complicated. Instead of the platinum, they have colloids that are made of a polymer, and they embed a little magnet in them. And the difference is that they're still immersed in hydrogen peroxide, but in order for the magnet hematite to catalyze the reaction, it needs blue light. And so this is a beautiful experiment because by shining light or switching light on and off, you actually make this colloid Brownian particle or active self-propelled particle. So let's see if this, I was going to give an instruction here. I was told red. Let's see. Yellow. Okay, and then pink to switch it off. So let's see. Now, of course, nothing will happen. Maybe the red wasn't pushed.
No.
Just wait. Too impatient. Okay. So there's a colloid about micron size, half a micron size. These things, when self-propelled, swim around at this speed of about 15 micron per second, not too different from E. coli. So the first move is a low concentration of this active colloid. And now, see, there's no light. They're just Brownian particles. They jiggle around like Brownian particles. When the light is on, it's sort of like a running tumble. They are self-propelled particles, and they change direction. They don't quite tumble. This is just rotational diffusion, so the change in angle is small, but it's not unlike the dynamics of E. coli. And this, by the way, are experiments by the NYU group of Paul Chaykin, Jeremy Palacci, and David Pine, and others. And at high density, when they are active, they form these clusters. They call them living crystals in their title, so they could make it two times. But they form these clusters. And as you will see in a minute, when the light is switched off, the clusters fall apart. And so the formation of the cluster is really driven by the activity. And what is really interesting here is that there has been work, again, by, I'm not mentioning the people, but some of them are here, essentially a very simple model, which is disks in two dimensions of finite size that are self-propelled and only have repulsive interactions, no attractions. And what these things can do, they can actually phase separate, meaning, I'm going to leave that here in a minute because I don't know if people can see here, though. Is it possible?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you have disks, these disks can repel each other if they touch, either soft repulsion or hard repulsion, it doesn't matter. But they're also self-propelled. So it's different from the Bichat model because now your disks have a finite size and off-point particle, and there are steric effects. You look at the behavior of these things, and what happens is that at some density, not even that high, you will find that there is a big, large, dense cluster. This is really a dense liquid surrounded by an active gas. So the system actually phase separates. And this happens essentially because of these, the dynamics of these particles. Detailed balance is broken. The active gas provides the additional pressure needed to hold this cluster together and overcome the repulsive interactions. What you saw in the movie is not quite complete phase separation like this, like cluster formation. And we have one question is to really try to understand the difference between these two systems. But the idea of a phase separation in a system with no attractive interactions, that's the point. I mean, we know systems with attractive interactions phase separate, but this one has no attractive interactions. And now people are very much interested in studying systems where you have two types of active particles, because then there are all kinds of activity-driven segregation phenomena, and see if they can relate it to self-segregation, which is a very important phenomenon, a very important mechanism for morphogenesis and so on. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about this type. And now I want to say a few words, if I can take a few more minutes, about the pneumatic case. And then I want to show you that because it's kind of a system that could be of interest also to the field theorists. Now, I will first of all show you an active pneumatic and then tell you the point I want to try to make here. Now, what the system is, it's a little bit complicated. So if you take a cell surrounded by a membrane, a bag, so I hope there are no biologists here, but so a cell is surrounded by a membrane, inside you have a nucleus, and then all kinds of other stuff, but in particular, there is a structure called the cytoskeleton, which is a polymer gel, is built by long, fairly stiff polymers, microtubules, actin, and others, cross-linked by many, many proteins. Among the proteins that cross-link this filament, there is a class, there are various classes also called motor proteins. Motor proteins are truly nanomachines that are capable of converting the chemical energy from a reaction, they use something called ATP as a fuel, into mechanical work, and literally walk along filaments. So there's something called kinesin, that's a motor protein, can walk on microtubules. Clusters of motor proteins can cross-link two microtubules, two filaments, and by walking along them, they actually move them, and therefore are continuously remodeling this polymer network called the cytoskeleton again. And the action of this motor protein is important for driving things like cell motility on a substrate, or even cell division as a matter of fact, and so on. So people have been doing, of course, understanding all of these is one of the goals of people working in active matter, but from an experimental point of view, people have been working on doing experiments in vivo where they extract this constituent, say microtubule and kinesin in this case. Microtubule is the filament, kinesin is the motor protein. And in these experiments, carried out at Brandeis by the group of Zwanninger-Dodge, they actually build bundles of microtubules cross-linked by clusters of kinesin. And when the kinesin walks along the microtubule, the bundle itself now is my active particle. The filaments, the microtubules can be moved relative to each other. And as I will show in this movie, which is a fairly low density, the white streaks are the bundles. So the bundles are continuously broken, reconnected, and so on. And of course, as the bundles are broken or are, the filaments are moved relative to each other, this active particle is exerting forces on the surrounding fluid. And so this is an active system. The bundles themselves are rod-like. And if they were passive, they could order in an emmatic liquid crystal state, where on average all the bundles are in the same direction. At high density, let's see what happens when the system is active. That is when there is this fuel ATP present. This is what you see. It's an emmatic liquid crystal, large region of order. But there is this continuous dynamics. This is now driven. There is no pressure applied, pressure difference applied at the boundary. There is no nobody shearing, nobody applying any forces. It's all internally driven by the consumption of this ATP, adenosine triphosphate. So what you see here, well, if you are at all familiar with the emmatic liquid crystals, you see all the region, and then you see these regions highlighted by the arrows. What are those? Those are the topological defects of an emmatic liquid crystals, which are called disclinations. Topological defects of every order parameter are regions where the order parameter has a strong spatial inhomogeneities. Sorry, region where the order, the direction of order has strong spatial inhomogeneities, the order parameter itself goes to zero at the core. These defects are dynamical, they're continuously generated and annihilated in the system. And in fact, you could say this is like a steady state with a, actually we've been studying this. And this is actually a steady state with a non-zero mean number of defects. So what you have here is particle creation and annihilation in the system going on all the time. The other interesting thing, I will just say it in words pointing at the figure. If I have, I'll say a little bit more, but and I'll make a drawing in a second, but I want to, when you will, the arrow appears, see, in equilibrium, of course, you have this kind of defects in an equilibrium pneumatic. If you quench a liquid crystal from the high disorder phase to low temperature, there are ordered regions separated by topological defects. Furthermore, the so-called topological charge is conserved, which means defects of opposite sign are always created, defects always created in pair, opposite sign. Opposite sign defects, like charges, attract logarithmically in two dimensions, and therefore as time goes on, the defects will attract, annihilate, and the system will reach a perfectly ordered state. The time may be very long, so this may not happen, but in principle, that's what should happen. So here, you see this comet-like region, that's the so-called plus 1F defect, and this like triangle kind of region is the minus 1F defect. And what I want you to show here is that you look again at the arrows, we have a plus 1F and minus 1F moving away from each other, repelling each other, and instead of attracting. And this is what can happen in active systems. So now I'll show you. Pink button. Now, I was told the pink button also will switch off the projector. Maybe not. How do I switch off the projector? I don't. Ah, the red button. Thank you. I'm supposed to finish at 45 minutes.
10 minutes.
Okay, I can take another minute here or two. Okay. So let me just, for those who are not necessarily familiar with topological defects and pneumatic crystals, let me just say a few more words about these. OK, Okay, so again, pneumatic liquid crystal in equilibrium now is a liquid of rods that can be in a disordered state, oriented in all directions, or in an ordered state. The ordered state, all these rods are on average aligned in the same direction. And the direction, the broken symmetry direction, is usually described by a unit vector called the director. But of course, there is a symmetry, the state with n is equivalent to the state with minus n. So the order parameter for this system is not a vector, but is a tensor, which is, if we are in two dimensions and the system has uniaxial symmetry, it's written as a trace tensor, usually in this form. If you like, if this is the z direction, QZZ is like the square of the cosine of the angle that this particle forms with that direction. S properly is the order parameter, so the pneumatic state has non-zero S, the disordered state has zero S. As I said, even in equilibrium, when you with the perfect order state is very hard to see, these systems generally have special inhomogeneities, and the particular special inhomogeneity I'm interested in are the topological defects, which really the structure of the topological defect is sort of like a fingerprint of the symmetry of the system. In fact, in the field of active matter, this has been used. So the movie I just showed you, you know, people were not necessarily sure whether these systems a priori would form a pneumatic state or more of a polar state. But when you see the structure, you see that immediately you see, aha, this is a pneumatic because the inhomogeneities are the structures of the defense of a pneumatic. So for pneumatic liquid crystals in equilibrium, the lowest energy defects are the following structure. Try to draw them. The lines I'm drawing will be lines tangent to the direction of the director n. So if you want to think of your molecules, say the molecules are aligned like these along those lines. And this is called a charge plus 1F disclination. Because if you start with a molecule pointing here, vertically here, and now you go around 360 degrees, and you look how much the molecule rotates to go back to this place, it only rotates 180 degrees in the same direction. So it's a plus 1F disclination. And the other lowest energy defect is a minus 1F disclination, which has structure of this type, where now the molecule rotates minus 180 degrees when you go around plus 360 degrees. So these are the topological defects on equilibrium, the pneumatic. You saw the same structures over there. In equilibrium, opposite sign defects of this type will attract each other with an interaction that is logarithmic, just like charges in two dimensions. But what happens in the active system is very interesting. Essentially, there are two characteristic time scales. And the way we've been studying these kind of things is indeed by writing what I would call a field theory, continuum equation for the order parameter. Now, this is a liquid crystal that also has flows. So continuum dynamical equations for the order parameter, the flow velocity of the system, and possibly the density, although the density remains fairly constant at these high densities. And what you find, essentially, is that in this system, remember, these are active particles. These microtubule bundles stretch out. As they stretch out, they exert forces on the fluid. So they create stresses locally. Local stresses create flows. And so these active particles that expand out create local flows, and these local flows for a particular type of active force, for instance, for this configuration. So a spatially inhomogeneous configuration of the order parameter as the one associated with defects will create flows. For this particular defects, we'll create shear flows that tend to point this way. And the defect itself can be thought of as a particle, if you like, will actually ride along with the flow. And so a plus 1F defect becomes like a self-propelled particle of its own. A minus 1F defect, because of the symmetry, the flow vanishes at the core, and so it doesn't move. but the plus one has that. And so what happens for a particular configuration, I think this is the right configuration for the system that I showed you before, is that, of course, there is the attractive interaction, but if the activity is large enough, this flow will be proportional to the activity. Actually, there is also this motion that tends to overcome the attractive interaction and allow for these things to fall apart. And essentially, there are two characteristic timescales in the system. One is the rate at which the energy is injected, is the rate at which ATP is consumed in the system. The other is the rate at which spatial inhomogeneity of the order parameter can relax, which depends on elastic constants and frictions. And when these two rates compete with each other, then you can have this spontaneous generation of defects, which of course can also then annihilate again, but you can actually get this steady state with a constant number of defects. Now, why would one care? Well, first of all, in theory, it's because it's very nice. But secondly, the reason we've been looking at these defects is as a way of trying to describe these really complex dynamics in terms of the dynamics of the defects themselves. Now, the kind of flaws that I just showed you in the movie vaguely resemble sort of what's called cytoplasmic streaming, which is complex motion that occurs in fluids inside cells, very often actually in plant cells, but also in eukaryotic cells. And so then you could ask, well, so what do defects, why would defects matter to cells? I don't have an answer to that. Maybe by the end of the program, so if you like, I can come back and see if we come up with one. But it's a very interesting system in which I think there's a lot of room for actually field theories to play a role. Of course, I didn't write down the field theory, but it's a very interesting one. So I think I will stop here because I'm possibly gone over time, and I hope there are some questions. Thank you.
In the effective field theories, these dynamical equations that you write down, do you have to add noise, and how? And if so, how do you work out what are the correlations of the noise, since you now don't have?
So, so far, most of the work has been done with equations without the noise. Mostly because you have no idea what the correlations of the noise will be. When noise is added, generally what you say is that you assume is Gaussian white noise we correlate with a strength of correlation that is not proportional to KT. And actually trying to figure out, I should say, there has been a little bit of work on trying to derive the noise from coarse-grained microscopic models that shows that generally the noise in the system is multiplicative, so it's not as simple as that. But understanding how to write down the noise and what it does is actually one of the, I think, open questions in these. So in what is different, so you mean what, I just want to, your question prompts me to say one more thing. I call it field theory. We often call it just hydrodynamic equations, which how are the hydrodynamic equations, say, for this active pneumatic different from those of an equilibrium pneumatic? The main difference is that there are stresses that are generated by these forces that the active particle exerts on the fluid that have a that would not be allowed in equilibrium. They have a symmetry that would not be allowed in equilibrium. And so they mainly come into the equation as stresses for the flow velocity. And they are the ones that are responsible for allowing for a steady state. So normally, you know, if you have a fluid and you're not applying any forces, the only solution you have is V equals zero. But because now these active stresses, which depend on orientation, can be balanced by shear flows, so you can actually have these dynamical states with spatial inhomogeneities that occur. But going back to your question, the noise is still something to look at very much.
In the movies that you showed, you didn't mention the boundary conditions. Are the boundaries sufficiently far away?
These were the boundaries in this case were far away. Boundaries conditions, of course, are also very important in this system, especially when you have the system that is moving revised moving one direction.
A real biological system makes a difference.
Absolutely, yes, and that's another thing that definitely.
You argued, I think, convincingly that the velocity and density fluctuations are both important in the system. But you might think in a tissue or some other situations, maybe a bacterial situation, that the density is high and maybe not varying terribly across the system. Is there any sense in which these can be decoupled? That is, could I still get interesting equations by studying?
Yes. Yes, you do.
Actually,
you do, and indeed, at very high density, people have shown, probably know that you could actually drop the density, because indeed, the density is so high. In the movie I showed you, the density was pretty much constant, other than possibly the very core of the defect, and so, yes, absolutely. Yes.
Can you look at plates in addition to rods?
At what?
At plates.
Well, so, you know, cells certainly are not rods, but they're not quite plates either. They are quite deformable. And so, we have looked at, we actually looked at disks, if you want. In the work on disks we did, that what we were trying to do is put in steric effects, which of course are very important once you go to high density, because these things cannot overlap with each other. Now, maybe what you could do is think of the very simplest first thing you could do. Of course, cells are deformable, they're very complicated things, but usually we think of particles as having hardcore repulsion. One thing that people have tried to look at is particles with relatively soft repulsions. That could be a way of mimicking the fact that actually cells not only are soft and deformable, but also can go over each other, as a matter of fact. But yeah, one could certainly do that. That's, yeah, you
could. Is there any regime in which the disclinations might attract rather than?
Yes, it depends. It depends. First of all, it depends on their orientation, and actually depends on the sign of the active forces. So there are these bundles I showed you, they tend to push out, and they exert what are called extensile stresses on the surrounding system, right, on the fluid. But say, for instance, another system, actin and myosin, which is what comes into our muscles, actually, you can think of these as bundles that pull in. So they exert contractile forces. And so depending on the orientation and depending on whether the forces are contractile or extensile, and in a given system in general, even for one size, say extensile system, then it depends on the orientation. So they can attract or repel depending on the orientation.
Do they form dislocations where they're sort of separated, or do they just collapse?
In any experiment I've seen them collapse. I mean like,
well, remember, we can ask more questions of Christina when she's in five. Thank you, Christina.
Thank you.